Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Davey, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing good, man. I'm all the better for talking to you. All the better for talking to you. It's been a long time. I was figuring out the other day, it's been almost 4 years, like to the week. It was in Birmingham when you were on tour with the Eagles. It was a week before you know what, and that was the last time I saw you and we hung out. And then the time before that, because obviously I'm thinking a lot, as I'm sure you are and everybody is at the moment, because shows aren't a thing. I keep thinking back to all the amazing nights that I've spent, you know, with people like yourself backstage at venues, catching up, having a drink, and just really soaking up the lifestyle that we've been blessed with for so long. And obviously when it's taken away, you realize more than ever how grateful you are to have experienced all the amazing things that you have. The time before that Birmingham show was one of my favorite nights ever. It was when you played in London at the, where was it? Coco, right? And there was Duff McKagan was there, Alex Turner was there, Matt Berry was there, Iggy Pop was there, all out to see you guys. You remember that night?
Oh, of course. Iggy Pop barefoot with his feet hanging over the railing. Of course. How can you forget that?
He rolled up, didn't he, with a leather jacket open, shirtless, beautiful woman on his arm. And we'd done an interview just before he arrived about your top 10 Iggy Pop songs. And then at the end of that chat, you were like, oh, well, Iggy's actually coming down tonight. And then sure enough, in he walks. Amazing.
Yeah, it's really been a sad time to not be able to go out and play or actually even hardly go out. You know, I haven't really been doing a whole lot other than just working on music at the studio and, you know, haven't really seen a lot of my friends, which is a drag, and, you know, obviously haven't seen you for a while, so.
I know you took some time off from Eagles. Were you playing shows with anybody else? Like, when was the last time you did do a tour or played live?
I've been playing a lot with Mojave Lords and Earthlings. We actually had a birthday show lined up at Pappy and Harriet's on June 7th, and of course, that didn't happen, but we had a lot of stuff set up for, you know, March, April, and May, and all that kind of just, you know, fell apart because, you know, no place was open yet. So I think the last time I played, we did a Mojave Lords and Earthlings show at Pappy and Harriet's in, I believe, February.
Right on. Well, I actually saw that exact same bill. We're going back some years now, maybe 5 years, I want to say, when me and my friend Cav came out to the Rancho, came to see you, and then me, you, Cav, and Bingo drove in one of your cars out to Pappy's, and it was, I think, that same bill. It was Mojave Lords, Earthlings, at Pappy and Harriet's, my first time there. What a joint. It's just like a wild cowboy spit and sawdust rock and roll joint, isn't it? One of my favorite venues I've ever been.
Yeah, it's one of the best ever. It's a really unique place, and the owners are super cool. And in fact, I told Bingo I was going to be talking to you today, and he said to say hello.
Oh, amazing. Please give him my love back. I can't wait to see you guys again, man. As soon as flights are allowed back into the US, I've definitely got a trip planned, because I've got a book coming out this year, Davey, and it's with an LA-based publishing house, and I was hoping to have my book launch party out in LA at the Viper Room. And then I was hoping to tie that in with a visit to you to catch up with you, but it wasn't meant to be this year. But yeah, I'm going to do a second book, and that'll be out next year. And hopefully by then things will have eased off a bit. Yeah, but please do give my regards and love right back to Bingo. So you guys, we're going to go back in time in a bit, Dave. I'd love to know all about your life and journey. But whilst we're on the subject of Bingo and, you know, the desert and what's going on now, for a while now, you and him have been developing your own mezcal, right? The Rancho de la Luna mezcal. I can't wait to try it. Tell me all about this new business venture of yours, Davey.
Well, it's pretty interesting. A while ago, Bingo suggested that we start our own tequila company because so many people drink tequila. And then we were told by a friend that maybe they could introduce us to some people that made mezcal, and we got involved with them, and that turned into a huge disappointment. They ripped us off, and it was a really horrible experience, but it got our toes in the water. And once we finished settling our legal woes with the people that ripped us off, we got together with some really cool people, and we just relaunched in last month. So we've only been going again for a month, and things are going way, way better. The first time we started out, we were going really good, and we were having a great time going around and seeing people and having parties and hosting things, and we were setting up lots of really cool things. But then our partners turned out to be thieves and hustlers, and they hustled us. So
what happened then? Did they nick the trademark or rip you off for money, or what went down?
Yeah, they nicked our trademark in Mexico.
Motherfuckers.
You don't even know. it was horrible, man.
Were you dealing with some cartel folks, Davey? Is that what it was?
No, they weren't that cool. They were just some low life that just ended up screwing us over.
Oh man.
But that led to us meeting our lawyer, who's super, super cool. And he introduced us to some other people, and now we've got an even better product, and we're working with the best team possible, and things are going gangbusters. You know, they've opened way more doors than we had open, but it's just a shame, because Bingo and I were traveling a lot and hosting events, and we're really having a lot of fun. That was, you know, kind of one of the main reasons that I stopped playing with Eagles of Death Metal, was we were doing so much and having such a good time doing that, and it was cutting into the time I could, you know, play with those guys.
So were you playing live, or was it more just like hosting parties and being like the face and the...
Well, we were doing both. We were going to like smaller bars and restaurants that didn't have live music, and we would DJ and host parties, and then
killer.
We would go to venues where our friends and other people had live music, and we would play Mojave Lords or Earthlings or whatever, and just host these events. And that, I mean, we're going to continue doing that as soon as we can. Another great thing that we started from it, there's a great charity called Sweet Relief, and they help musicians that don't have health insurance. And our neighbor and great friend Victoria Williams started that a while ago, and we put together the Sweet Relief Music Hour, and we had our first shows happening in March, and then that got kind of sidelined. But we just filmed the very first episode at the Rancho. We just did it here with Victoria Williams, who started it. And it's called the Sweet Relief Music Hour, and all the proceeds from that go to helping people that don't have, you know, musicians that don't have health insurance, and they've helped everybody. They helped Fred Drake a lot, who I started the studio with. They helped Bingo. They helped everyone, almost anyone that you can think of that I know, they've helped a lot. And I know, you know, so that is a really big, that was kind of our favorite thing that happened from the Mezcal, was helping Sweet Relief, because they've helped so many and they continue to help people.
Well, I think in the UK, we obviously have our own problems, but we take for granted, I think, the free health service that this country offers. And obviously in a country like America, where that's not just a right, it's not just your God-given right to live in that country and be taken care of, you have to pay. It's a real struggle, isn't it, financially, for creative people, especially right now, if you don't have any income and you get something go wrong with you. Those medical bills can cripple you, can't they? No pun intended.
Oh my gosh, yeah. You know, like I haven't had insurance since the early 90s. I haven't been able to afford it, you know, and I don't make a very comfortable living. You know, I worked hard, and a lot of the money I make goes back into the studio and whatever, and to the businesses. But I don't know many people that can afford health insurance over here. So everyone just kind of, you know, hopes that they stay healthy, and if they don't, then they rely on people like Sweet Relief, or, you know, any other, there are a few other, you know, cool charities that help people. But yeah, it's rough, man. It's expensive for someone like me. I'm approaching 60. I'll be 60 next year.
Are you really? Wow.
Oh yeah, man. I'm an old, old. Yeah. But like for me, for health insurance, I think it's probably close to like $1,000 a month for decent health care.
Yeah, that's crazy. So, that's like rent money, isn't it? That's like what you pay for a decent apartment in London.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard on top of all the other things. And like you said, especially now that people are out of work, you know, people are getting a little bit of help. Some people are getting a little bit of unemployment. Some people aren't. A lot of my friends, almost everyone I know is either a musician, an artist, or they work in the entertainment field as, you know, even a restaurant or whatever, you know, and almost everyone's out of work right now because, you know, service industry jobs are just almost non-existent. They're starting to come back a little bit, especially in a few states, but it's really hard times, as well as, I mean, I'm sure over there it's rough as hell.
Yeah, well, it's the same for me. I'm in the same boat. Everybody, apart from my old school friends, everybody who's in my day-to-day life now is, as you say, either like a musician in the music industry or in the hospitality trade, either a barman or a bar owner or a waitress, or, you know, they're a sound technician or a guitar tech or whatever. Everybody that I know is in those lines of work, events and hospitality, and, you know, they're the ones that have definitely been hit the hardest. It sounds like you've been doing some cool, productive, positive stuff, though, even whilst the shutters have been clamped down. It sounds like it's, you know, it's all go your side, which is cool, man. That's reassuring and good to hear.
Well, you know, we're trying our hardest. You know, the cool thing is, you know, the Mezcal did get going, and we are able to continue doing the Sweet Relief Music Hour, which will help a lot of people. The studio, I haven't had any sessions since March because,
I'll bet,
you know, yeah, no one's really wanting to get together in a small space. But I've been working on lots of stuff. We finished the new Mojave Lords. We're getting ready to work on some Earthling stuff. I haven't even really had anyone over here until we did the Sweet Relief Music Hour, and everyone got tested, and as soon as the negative test came in, we were able to get together and work, which is cool. And, you know, just trying to keep it together. But, you know, everybody's, you know, we're trying to at least stay positive and try to create as much as possible. I've written a lot of music, and, you know, we'll see when we can all get together to finish it.
Amen. And I look forward to coming out and seeing you and drinking some of that mezcal on your porch, man, and soaking up the desert vibes with a nice glass in hand.
Oh, man. You are way overdue for a visit here, my friend. Yeah. We need to get back. Maybe you can do a book release at Happy and Harriet's, and we can have a couple of bands play and make a bunch of mezcal drinks for you.
Fucking A, man. That would be the dream. All right. Consider that on the list of things to do once the world reopens. So,
I'm on it.
I've been doing some digging on you, my friend, in the lead up to today, just out of interest. And there's so much about your life that I don't know about. I'd love to get into it with you today. Well, as much as we can cover, there's a lot. So you grew up in Memphis, Tennessee. Am I right in thinking that?
That is correct.
So that's where that hospitality that you exemplify comes from, that old school Southern hospitality, right? Because you are one of the most like generous, hospitable people that I know. And does that come from your upbringing in Memphis? Did you grow up kind of in a household that was open doors, cookouts, that kind of traditional idea that you have of Southern living? Was that your life growing up? Or
yes, absolutely. And I certainly appreciate the kind words there. I try to be as hospitable as I can. But yeah, I grew up in the South, and that's kind of what you did, you know. A lot of people didn't have a lot, so you just kind of came together and shared. When I was a kid, like when I was up until I was 7, I lived in Arkansas. And on Sundays at this big, it was like a metalworking place, everybody would show up and with everything they caught, all the fish they caught and whatever, and they would have this big party, a fish fry every Sunday. And it was Sunday afternoon, and that was kind of my first experience as to, you know, like a whole town. Because the place I grew up in when until I was 7 was 243 people. So everybody would just and throw together and have a great party. So that was where I kind of learned that. And then when I got into Memphis, you know, like it was kind of the same thing. Not quite, you know, it's a little bit bigger of a city. But yeah, I grew up hanging out with a lot of my friends, and we all, you know, I started playing music pretty young, not super young, but when I was 15, and immediately started playing with friends. So that was a good way to get together and, you know, share stories and have fun.
Well, I mean, you look at the musical history and heritage of that city, right? And obviously you had Sun Studio and Stax, and the amount of artists that came through those labels in, you know, the 50s, 60s, even going into the 70s. Obviously, you were born, what would you have been born then? 1961, if you're 60 next
Correct.
Year. So you would have been
Correct.
Too young to kind of be a part of that. But did that scene linger? And as you grew older, did you notice the afterwaves of all of that soul and rockabilly and that music? Was it entrenched in the town, in the local kind of music community? Did you see that? Or had things moved on by the time you were old enough to be aware of that?
No, obviously, you know, like, obviously, you know, everybody was aware of that, because that's, you know, a big draw for the city. And also, you know, in the 20s through the 40s, you know, you had a lot of giant blues greats coming through. You know, Memphis was a big blues town too. So it was pretty steeped in very cool music. And, you know, even in the 70s, we still had a lot of people coming through. The Bar K's had big hits, and, you know, it was a place where everyone from ZZ Top to the Cramps and whatever, you know, would come to record. And I actually had a friend that worked at Arden Studio, and this was probably in 1977 or 78, and a couple of us worked at Peaches Records and Tapes, and one of our buddies was a janitor at Arden Studios, and he called us up at about 9 o'clock. I think we got off work at 10. He said, "Look, man, I've got the late shift tonight. No one's in Studio B. Come on down. I've got Studio B for a couple hours from midnight on." So we got off work, went to Arden, and we got to record a song there. And that was in the Bar K's. We're actually in another studio working.
Amazing.
And yeah, it was, you know, it was a very interesting town to come up in. But yeah, everybody was aware of rockabilly. You know, Sun Studios was still there. Arden Studio was, you know, really going gangbusters at that time, because everybody was recording there. People were coming from all over the world to record at Arden. And so, yeah, and there was a great scene there. There was a really cool music scene, and I started playing out in like 78, 79, and there was a really cool scene that kind of was punk, country, new wave, everything kind of combined at once in Memphis, and there were a couple of cool places that you would play, and lots of really great people. Alex Chilton,
was Big Star a big band, and you know, was Alex Chilton a key figure in the scene? Did you ever have like any experiences or encounters with him?
Oh yeah, of course. We were really good friends.
Amazing.
So he played with a band called Panther Burn, who still play around. Tav Falco still plays around. And I remember going to see them one night, and Alex was playing guitar, and it really influenced my whole style of guitar playing and everything. And then we started playing, and he sometimes played bass with a band called the Modifiers that I played with. And Big Star was really well known amongst like certain people, but like he was very well known for the Box Tops because they had huge number one hits, and Big Star never really got that big, you know, like later on they influenced everybody because they were such a great band. But we played lots and lots of shows together and hung out a lot. And in fact, one of my favorites is my band Modifiers, one of our first out of town gigs, we drove to New Orleans to play a show. And it was right when Alex had moved to New Orleans. He was a dishwasher at the Court of Two Sisters. And we stayed with him, but the people never showed up to let us in the club to play. So we sat across the street at the bar waiting for them to open. And we just progressively got drunker and drunker until we realized the people weren't going to let us in the bar. So during this time, we'd met this group of girls who said they knew of a bar across town that we could play at. So we jumped in our van with Alex, and we drove across to this place called the Rose Tattoo.
Amazing.
And it was right across the street from Tipitina's, and it was like a little bar, you know, mostly older people. And the girls talked the owner into, she was super nice, older lady, talked her into letting us play some songs for free drinks. And our singer had gotten so drunk, we couldn't wake him up. So Alex said he would sing. So we ended up playing a bunch of stuff. We did some Box Top songs, some Elvis and stuff. We did about five songs, and then the owner told us we were scaring people out of our bar, so we had to quit. but that night we went back to Alex's house, and he had an open tuned guitar, and it was open tuned to the Spanish G, which is what Keith Richards used, and he showed me some slide guitar that night. I'd never done open tuning or slide guitar. And then you fast forward to when I started playing with Eagles of Death Metal. It just so happens that that's the tuning Jesse plays in. Every Eagles of Death Metal song is in open Spanish G. So I was able to kind of figure out the songs pretty quickly because I was familiar with that tuning from Alex Chilton. So that's kind of a long story, but that's how I got into, you know, like I knew Alex really well, and he got me into some really cool tunings and different styles of guitar playing.
Well, dude, it just sounds like such a wild, fun, free time as well, which we're obviously, you know, forget about COVID, even like in recent times, it feels like the red tapes come in a lot more, and it's just not like that anymore, is it? You can't just roll up to cities, meet people, get introduced to a bar owner, play that night. Like that kind of freedom and naivety and spontaneity and danger and excitement that was just clearly there in abundance in those days, I feel like a lot of that's gone now. Not to be like the grumpy old guy, but it sounds like a very wild, free, fun time.
Yeah, it was. And you know, like at the time there were these giant empty mansions that were in disrepair in Memphis, and like a lot of the guys from that I played with, they had a house that was, I think it was like probably $300 a month. And it was literally like eight bedrooms, and two of them you couldn't go into because, you know, they were just, the floors were falling apart and stuff was growing in them. And, but we could rehearse there. So, you know, you had like five or six people paying 40, 50 bucks a month to live in a house that you could live in, rehearse in, you know, have parties in. And I don't know, in cities how often that happens anymore. I mean,
yeah.
I'm sure it does somewhere, but you know, when I was a kid, definitely that was more happening than not, where, you know, just a bunch of people lived in these great houses. I remember going to San Francisco for the first time in the early 80s, and same thing, these kids would have this giant Victorian mansion, you know, that was, and that's where you would stay. You would stay with these like six kids that were renting this giant house. But now those houses, a house like that, if you had the whole house, would be like, you know, $20,000 a month or something.
Yeah, and as you say, like when it's affordable, that is conducive to creating art, isn't it? Because you're not worrying about paying your bills. So you've got the space, you've got a roof over your head, and then you're free then to just use all your time to play about and hone and develop your skills. And now I think so many artists have to like get out and make the money to pay rent, and then there's less time to be creative. And it's just, yeah, man, like in so many ways, I think the party's over. But hey, you sounds like you very much caught it, dude. It sounds like you had some good time. So what took you originally out? You mentioned New Orleans there. I gather you kind of end up there a little bit later on. But what takes you out to Hollywood and Los Angeles out west to begin with in the early 80s?
Well, the band The Modifiers that I went to New Orleans and a couple other small cities with, we played this really crazy show opening for the Gun Club in Memphis on my mother's birthday, strangely enough.
Why was it crazy? And, just because?
Well, it was crazy because I took my mom out to dinner and took her home, and she wasn't supposed to come to the gig. You know, that was kind of our dinner night. You know, she didn't really come to our shows very often. But so I dropped her off. And me and my girlfriend and a bunch of the guys in the band took acid, and we played this show, and the crowd hated us. And me and the guitar player were both on acid, and the singer was so drunk he was being really crazy. I guess this isn't a good way to tell kids how to have a band. But at the time, you know, this was like 1982. Or
it worked for then. It worked for then.
Yeah. But our guitar player just went on this super hate rant. I'll never forget, like, you know, how much he hated all the people in the audience because they hated us, you know. And we were just, we're kind of doing like rock, but noise rock. And I was doing like lots of loud feedback. And anyway, so we get off, we finish the set, and we get off, and there's my mom with my brothers. And luckily, she rarely drank, but that night she had drank, so she didn't quite realize the whole drunken hate fest thing going on. She just thought, she's like, oh, you guys are really good, you know? And she had a good time. So, and so anyway, the Gun Club plays, they're amazing. And
what a band.
Oh, my God, yeah, the best, man. I love them. And they were one of my favorites at the time, too. So,
Lanigan talks a lot in his book about his absolute love for that band and for Jeffrey in particular.
Oh, my God, yeah. So, well, what happened is they ended up staying with the singer and the guitar player from my band for a few days, and we were all hanging out. And he was kind of... he was kind of jonesing. At the time, he was doing a lot of heroin, and he was really having a hard time because it was at the end of July, and it was super, super hot, and they didn't have air conditioning. But we all became friends, and he was like, look, the last show on our tour is in L.A., on the American tour. You guys should come out and open that. And being, you know, 20-year-old kids, I think I was 21, and the other guys were a little bit older, like 25, 26. And we were like, okay, we'll drive from Memphis to L.A. to play a show.
Well, you're probably not even getting paid, right? You're just doing it for the crack.
Oh, I think we got it. I think we got $100 or something. Right. Definitely didn't for the trip. But I think we were just like, at the time, we were like, yeah, you know, that's what you did. You went to Hollywood or New York if you wanted a chance at really doing this for a living, you know, that you kind of went to one of those places. So we jumped in my 1974 Toyota Corolla station wagon And it was just me, the singer, and the guitar player. And we decided, we're just going to go there. We'll find a drummer. And if we don't find a bass player, I'll play bass, because I could play. I played bass in a couple of bands. And then if we can find a drummer, bass player, all the better. So the whole way there, we talked about how Fear had just broken up, and maybe we could get the rhythm section from Fear to play with us. And strangely enough, we pull into town the first night. I met three girls that I ended up playing in bands with over the years. The very first night we're in town, we met Durf Scratch, the bass player from Fear, who said he would play bass with us. The Fear's drummer would not do it because he wasn't playing with anyone at the time. He was kind of over it. But Durf said he knew of a drummer. So we had one day to show these guys like six songs. We learned six songs. We opened for the Gun Club and a couple other bands, but we were the opening band. And people really liked what we were doing, so we immediately got asked to play more shows while we were there. So we ended up extending our stay and playing a few more shows.
Who else did you play with? Anybody notable that I'd know?
Well, we opened for the Circle Jerks.
Oh, wow.
They were friends of ours, and they had a show that they threw us on a bill. We played with a band called Tex and the Horseheads, who were friends of ours that we met there, that kind of like that. And I ended up playing with the singer from Tex and the Horseheads for a long time. So we played a couple of shows, and then people wanted us to play more shows. So what we did is we went home, we regrouped, we got our, you know, once we got back to Memphis, and we told people that we actually did well in LA. Then our drummer decided to come out with us to play some shows, because at that point we decided that Durf would be the bass player, since he was connected in LA. You know, he knew people.
Yeah.
So our drummer, who couldn't make the first trip because it was such a, you know, it was like, do you guys want to open us up for us in a week in LA? So our drummer couldn't make it. Everybody else, we just quit our jobs and split. So we came back, regrouped, rehearsed, went back to LA, rehearsed for a couple of shows, and then we opened for Black Flag. We opened some shows for those guys, and then we had a couple of our own shows that we actually headlined, because since we were an out-of-town band, that gave us a little more, you know, cred for getting our own shows going. And we kind of took off, you know, we started doing pretty well. There was a movie being made called, I can't remember the name of the movie right now, but we got a couple of songs in this movie, and it was Alan Sachs, who did Rock and Roll High School, and he had done Welcome Back Cotter and a couple of other things. So we thought it was, you know, this is going to be our big break, you know. It was called Dubedio.
Brilliant.
But we thought it was our big break. We're going to get into movies. This is our whole thing. And, of course, nothing ever happened with that movie. But we ended up staying a little longer. And then we, you know, at one point we all kind of ran out of money. And we were living with Durf in a one-room apartment. Like, he would go stay with his girlfriend, and the three of us would stay in this tiny-ass little place. So we finally went back to Memphis and regrouped another time and decided, like, all right, this time we're going to move out there. Let's get our shit together. And we all moved out. We got a house in Venice, and we ended up living in L.A. And that's how I ended up, like, staying in L.A. It took a couple of times, because the first time we weren't really shooting for living there. We were just going to play the gig. But that immediately set us off on getting more things going. But LA was really, really cool. We had opened for so many LA bands that had come through Memphis that we were really good friends with Black Flag and Circle Jerks, and they were very, very instrumental in helping us meet cool people and get gigs, you know.
What an exciting time Los Angeles must have been at that point as well. What an exciting place, at that time. Like, you kind of obviously had the alternative rock boom about to explode with Jane's Addiction and Chili Peppers and those kind of bands, and obviously Fishbone and Guns N' Roses, and then you had the punk thing. Like, it must have just been fucking wild and so full of freaks and creatives. And Was it evident as soon as you got there that that was the place you had to be? Like, was it just kicking?
Absolutely. You know, there were, it was so great because there were so many great bands. People were, you know, plus I was 22, 23 when I, you know, I was very, very young and ready to experience all this. But yeah, there was so much going on. There was so much great art. There were so many great bands. I mean, of all the bands that you mentioned, which are all great, there were so many great bands that no one's ever heard of either that we were playing with, you know, that that didn't make it, that we just played gigs together. And there was a very great sense of camaraderie amongst all the bands. Everybody liked each other. If we were playing a show together, that was a great night for all of us to get together and have fun. There were so many clubs, so many after-hours bars. You would, you know, you would play your gig, and then you would go to an after-hours bar to drink. Or there was a one place called Ground Zero in the later 80s that of all of our friends worked at, and it opened at 2 in the morning and stayed open till 10 in the morning. And they sold, like, LSD punch, and they had Coke that they would sell. I mean, it was already illegal being open after 2 a.m., but they just added everything else. So you could smoke weed and you could do whatever you want. So we would play there a lot as well. So we'd play our regular gig and then go over there and play these shows. But yeah, it was a crazy exciting time to be in LA. It was amazing.
Is Ground Zero the place that Fishbone sing about in that song, Party at Ground Zero? Is that what that song's about?
You know, you'd have to ask them, but I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, you know, they used to play some really great shows. You know, we were all friends too. In fact, twice I saw Fishbone, there were riots. I saw them play at the downtown LA street scene, which they only had for like 1 year because there were giant riots. But in the middle of their set, a riot started. And then I saw them open for the Dead Kennedys at the Olympic Auditorium. And someone kept throwing stuff. I mean, it was a crazy scene there too. Someone threw a boot and it hit Norwood in the head, and he jumped off the stage to, like, he saw the guy that did it, and when he jumped down, someone knifed him in the back.
Fucking hell.
And he didn't realize it, and he got up on stage and finished the set, and, you know, somebody finally was like, dude, you're bleeding. And he got off stage. But that was, like, you know, they were such a great live band. They would get people so worked up. I mean, they still are a great live band, and that's been forever. But yeah, there were just so many bands like that that you'll never have heard of that were equally as great. I mean, as there are everywhere in the whole world. Every town and city has so many bands that you've never heard of because they just never did anything. But, you know, it's all about art for art's sake and music for music's sake, you know, just getting out there and doing it.
I can only imagine the cast of characters as well as musicians and artists. You've obviously probably got drug dealers, hookers, strippers, trannies, hobos, street pimps, like the full cast of characters, right?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, man. we were going to our gig one night and there was a pimp with a fucking samurai sword that thought, I guess someone had fucked with his girls. And he thought it was us, and he was trying to cut us in half with his samurai sword one night. I mean, and that was just like a typical night in LA back then. You know, it was a really, really fun time, crazy and fun. You know,
what was Tex like?
Tex is awesome. She's still a great friend of mine. She lives in Austin, and I see her whenever I play. She's just a very free, awesome lady, one of a kind. And wrote great songs, great lyrics, super, super fun. And we lived together, myself, her boyfriend, and my friend Larry Mullins, who now plays with Nick Cave. He's played with everybody from Iggy and Nick Cave. And, you know, he's played with so many great bands, Swans.
Oh, wow.
And we all lived together for a while. Oh, my God, yeah, he's one of the greatest. He's one of the greatest musicians and just the coolest dude too. But we all lived together and we all had a great time. You know, he was even younger. by the time we were living together, he was the 21-year-old, and I think I was like 26 at that time. So he was like the baby. But we had a cool little house in Hollywood that was super cheap, and we had a garage that we could rehearse in all hours. And that, you know, that's another thing that I don't know how many people can afford a house with a garage with a couple of people living in the house, you know?
Yeah, especially not in LA. Fucking hell.
No. No. But that was an interesting time for sure.
What about this band, the Ringling Sisters, that you were in? You did a record with Lou Adler, right?
That's correct. In fact, Larry played drums on that album.
There you go.
And Tex was supposed to be on the record, but it started as a bunch of girls doing poetry. And it was like, that was the thing. It's like, we would all do poetry at these poetry readings and stuff, but it was mostly females that started the Ringling Sisters. And then they decided maybe one of the girls had a boyfriend that wrote really great songs. They're like, well, maybe we'll do some songs. And then they're like, well, we're all friends. Why don't you play, Dave? And I'm like, okay, cool. And they're like, well, we need a drummer. Larry, why don't you play? So we all started doing these shows. And it was very, very mellow. It was kind of like the Mamas and the Papas. And everybody in the band had like punk rock bands. So this was a complete, you know, 180 for everyone playing these mellow songs. But we all loved each other. Everyone was super cool and fun. And the music was cool. So we started doing those gigs as well as our punk rock bands. And we did one show it was funny. It was at a clothing store. And it was really one of our worst shows. It was one of those shows where basically everything goes wrong, but no one was like crying about it. We were all just kind of laughing like, oh, I broke a string, but I didn't bring us any backup strings for the guitar and, you know, that kind of thing. And it turns out that Lou Adler had sent his secretary to check us out and said that, like, well, it was interesting, but they were really cool. And so he set up a thing for us to go to On the Rocks, which is above the Roxy. It's a private club, and do a set for him. And he was like, I love it. I think we can do a great record together. We can do it at my studio in Malibu. And we all went for it. Unfortunately, at the time, Tex didn't want to do it. She liked everybody, but she thought it was, you know, it wasn't heavy enough.
Yeah, so it wasn't a bit really too commercial.
Yeah, it was too commercial, but we all were just like, well, fuck, man. You know, none of our other bands is getting signed, so let's do this. And so we did an album with Lou Adler, who is one of the coolest dudes ever. You talk about somebody you should interview. Like that,
oh, man.
That guy.
He's the dream guest. Like, he's Mr. Hollywood royalty. Like, he, if people listen to this don't know that name, he owned the whiskey, right? But as well as that, he was involved in producing and or discovering everything from Cheech and Chong to the Rocky Horror Picture Show, Carole King, Mamas and Papas that you mentioned a minute ago. Like, that's some OG Hollywood royalty right there, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. The Roxy, the whiskey that he also put on the Monterey Pop Festival.
Oh, wow.
He was friends because he had done the Mamas and the Papas. So, you know, John Phillips, and he put on the Monterey Pop Festival. They were friends with Hendrix and the Stones and everything. So it's his life, man. You talk about some crazy stories. That guy has the best story.
Did you ever go out with him and socialize with him and his Hollywood pals?
A couple of times. He actually hired our band to be the backup band for the 15th anniversary of Rocky Horror Picture Show.
No.
And
that's amazing. Yeah,
it was really, really amazing.
With the full cast.
Everybody except for Susan Sarandon and Tim Curry, neither of them participated for whatever reason.
But you had like Meatloaf and Richard O'Brien and...
Oh, yeah. I got to play science fiction double feature, just me and Richard O'Brien, me on acoustic.
Man.
But the funny thing is before the show, we decided that we were all going to take mushrooms. So
I'm noticing a pattern here, Davey.
Well, you know, some of the crazier nights of your life are involving
Hey, I fully back it, mate. I fully back it. I love it.
But it was really funny because it was for 1,500 of the presidents of the fan clubs around the world. So it was 1,500 of the biggest fans of Rocky Horror Picture Show, all in drag. You know, they're Rocky Horror drag. So were we. And it was one of the most incredible nights. You know, like hanging out with everybody. Jack Nicholson came, and Lou was like, "Hey, you guys have any weed? Jack wants to get stoned." And we're like, "Yeah!" So we all got to smoke weed with Jack Nicholson, and you know, like there were so many stars there. And you know, I'm a huge fan of Rocky Horror Picture Show. So just Richard O'Brien, he is such a freaky, awesome dude. You know,
yeah.
And everybody else in the whole cast was there, except for, unfortunately, you know, no Tim Curry or Susan Sarandon, but everybody else. It was really, it was an awesome evening.
What a night. And only in Hollywood, right? Only in Hollywood would something like that happen. And what an amazing place to be tripping on shrooms as well, with 1,500 Rocky Horror costumed up fanatics. That's an incredible setting.
I just remember sitting with Pleasant Gaiman, who's one of my, you should interview her too, because she honestly has more amazing stories than anyone I've ever met in my life. Like she was a teenage groupie when she was like 14 or 15. And man, the stories with that, she's now a world famous belly dancer and she does a podcast, but maybe interview her because she has the best stories. But I just remember sitting in the crowd and we were tripping our balls off, laughing so hard at what was going on. I was like, we've had so many, at that point we'd already had a million amazing times together. Cause she was the first person I met in LA.
Oh, she was there that night when you played with the Gun Club. You said you met three girls that you ended up jamming with. She was one of them.
She was one. Tex was one. And Iris Berry, who was also in the Ringling Sisters, was another one.
Right on.
But I just never forget us laughing our asses off, just saying, like, all right, this is it. How much weirder can it get for us, you know? And then, of course, it just kept getting weirder year after year after year. But yeah, that was a true highlight of existence, is playing that. You know, that was a really interesting evening.
Well, I have to ask you, Davey, if that's the kind of stuff you're getting up to in Hollywood in the 80s, what makes you leave to go out to New Orleans? There must have been something pretty amazing on offer down there for you to want to leave.
Well, I guess, I think that was 1990, the 15th anniversary, I believe. And then a couple of years of slugging it out. I mean, the whole time I'm in LA, I'm like working at restaurants, delivering pizzas, you know, because as everyone in the music industry knows, that's your best gig. It's usually, you know, you can get off, for your gigs if you're working at a pizza joint, because all the other people are musicians, so you just kind of coordinate your gigs over the next few weeks. And you know, so, and plus it's a job you don't mind quitting if something better comes along musically.
Yeah, it's not a career, is it?
No, it's not a career. And you know, like I've been slugging it away in LA and I loved all my friends, I loved all my bands, but it was kind of on the decline. And, you know, I was like 31 instead of 21. And I'd had a good 10 years of playing in LA. And
did the Ringling Sisters project not kick off into anything major then? Did that just kind of come and go?
Well, strangely enough, the day that our album was set to come out, A&M, which is what our, Lou Adler had a label called Ode Records, and it was distributed through A&M because he had started, he was really good friends with Herb Alpert, who had A&M. And the day that our album was set to come out, A&M fired most of their staff. It was just one of those like bloody Mondays or whatever, you know, where they just like they canned everybody, including all the people that were working on our album. Like every single person that had anything to do with our album was fired. And at that point we just got buried in the shuffle because, you know, of all the stuff they were putting out, ours was like the small fry thing, you know?
Yep.
So it just got buried and nothing ever happened with that album, unfortunately. It's a pretty cool album, actually. It's mellow. The poems and lyrics on it are awesome. The songs are cool. But yeah, nothing really happened with that. And we kept going, like the girls kept going even after that. But what had happened is a couple of people from the Ringling Sisters had a band called the Continental Drifters. And they were going to New Orleans for, they had a gig for Jazz Fest. And I actually had played on and off in the band. Like I was an auxiliary member. If one of the guys couldn't make it, I would play. So we were all very good friends and we played together. And they were going to New Orleans for Jazz Fest. And I needed a vacation. And I said, look, I'll drive and help you guys. I'll do whatever just so I can go with you guys. They had rented an RV. I was like, look, I got tons of weed and mushrooms. We'll have a great time. I'll be the roadie, whatever, just so I can go down there. So we drove straight 32 hours. We didn't stop. We just drove straight singing songs. I mean, it was a pretty amazing band. It had some really Peter Holzapfel was one of the guys. He played with REM for a long time and he had the DBs. He's a great singer songwriter. And Vicki Peterson from the Bengals was in the band. She's an amazing singer. And Susan Cowsill was with Peter Holzapfel. They were a couple. And she's one of the best singers in the world. So it's a really cool band and really cool people. And we drove to New Orleans straight and we got out of the van at their manager lived in New Orleans and we got to his office and the first guy that opened the door was a guy named Jimmy Ford and we immediately just clicked. We became best friends. We're still best friends to this day. And we had a great time. The New Orleans is the best, especially in the early 90s. It was like LA, but even crazier, the Wild West.
Really? Like lawless, dangerous, exciting, all of it.
Yeah, oh my God. So crazy, so great. So we had a great time there. I met a lot of people, a lot of really good friends. I had the best time. We were there for like a week or so and went back to LA and we were hanging out, doing our thing. And then Larry got hired to play drums with Iggy Pop. And he was going to New Orleans to record the record at Daniel Lanois' studio. And he asked if I wanted to go. He's like, hey, do you want to cruise with me? And, that way I have my van and, you can help me drive. And I'm like, yeah, that'd be great. I can go see all these people I just met a few months ago. So, I call up Jimmy Ford. He's like, oh, dude, just stay at my place. You're totally welcome to just stay at my place. And I'm like, all right, great. So I jump in the van with Larry. We have a great road trip. We end up at Daniel Lanois' house. No one's there for a couple of days before we've gotten there early. So they let us stay at the studio, which is the most incredible place ever. The greatest studio I've ever been in.
Has he still got it? Is it still there?
No, he sold it a long time ago, but the building obviously is still there. But it's right at the edge of the French Quarter.
Right, right.
Like the most beautiful house. It had every cool instrument and microphone and piece of recording gear that you'd ever want. He had the console from Electric Ladyland that Hendrix had installed. That was his recording console.
Shit.
So, I mean, it was crazy. And so I hung down there with Larry and Iggy and those guys. So that was really, really fun. Like they would work and then, Larry would call me up like, hey, we're going to go to so-and-so, to a bar to dinner, meet us, and I'd go out with this to dinner and stuff.
So you've known Iggy years, Davey.
Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely. In fact, I had worked a show the night before Larry, auditioned for him. It was a show that Iggy played and I ended up changing a guitar string for Iggy because he broke a string during the rehearsal. And we were talking and I was like, yeah, tomorrow my buddy Larry's going to be you know, auditioning. He goes, oh man, is that crazy dude that's been like stalking me? And I'm like, yeah, because Larry had been stalking him because he really wanted to play with Iggy because he's, you know, Iggy. So I was like, yeah, but you're going to love him. He's the coolest dude. He's a great, great drummer. And sure enough, the next day, Larry got the gig. And so when we were hanging out, you know, it was just great to be in New Orleans and hang out with those guys. But at the same time, I was hanging out with my buddy Jimmy. And, a really funny side note. Well, it's not that funny, but it's an interesting side note. Is on the way there, I called Jimmy and I'm like, hey, we'll be there tomorrow afternoon. He's like, okay, just so you know, last night someone broke in my house and I had to shoot him. And I haven't had time to clean up the bedroom, but don't worry, you know, I'll get it as clean as possible before you get there. Turns out this guy, a murderer, had broken into his house, had a giant knife. Jimmy shot the guy's hand, blew off half the guy's hand. He left his fingers there. He ended up getting apprehended. Which turned out he had murdered and raped people, like a total evil dude. And I got into the house the next day, and there was still buckshot in the wall with blood on the carpet.
Welcome to your sleeping quarters.
Yeah, welcome to, like, he's like, I'm gonna leave the shotgun next to the bed. And he goes, I've never had any problem. It just is one of those things. So anyway, that's a crazy side note. So I'm hanging out with Jimmy a lot, and then it's time for me to fly home, and Jimmy and I go out for one last night out on the town, and he stops by this bar. He goes, I got to show you this bar. This is a really cool bar. This is where we, you know, we all hang out. And we walk in, there's only two people besides the bartender, and they're both of the ladies are his, both of his aunts, and they're sitting there, you know, they sound like the sisters from The Simpsons.
Yeah.
Super cheap beer, cigarettes, like, hey, how you doing? and, you know, he shows me this place, and, you know, he's like, look, I'm, you know, look at this place. Should, you know, somebody should be doing something. It's got this cool venue here and everything. It's this beautiful, beautiful place in like a little neighborhood in the middle of nowhere. So takes me to the airport the next morning. I get home. You know, the next day he calls me. He's like, hey, man. That place that I took you to, they need someone to take it over. And I'm like, okay. And he's like, yeah, you know, somebody needs to run the restaurant. And I'm like, okay, I'll ask around. And he goes, no, man, it's got to be you. And I'm like, well, I would, but I don't really know much about restaurants, and, you know, other than delivering pizzas. And, you know, I live in LA. And he's yeah. like, no.
What makes you think I'm your guy?
yeah. He's like, no, I'm telling you, it has to be you. And I'm like, dude, you know, there's no way. And he goes, well, let me tell you what it is, what the deal is first. And I'm like, okay, what's the deal? And he goes, all right, so I showed you that place. It's a three-story building. He goes, if you take the kitchen, you don't get the bar, because the owner wants somebody to get people into his bar. So for $1,000 a month, you can have the kitchen and restaurant. You can have the venue, which holds like 350 people, and you can have the two floors above it, which is like six bedrooms.
Wow.
And I was like, $1,000? He goes, oh yeah, it includes utilities. And I'm like, let me get this straight. I get the restaurant, the venue, the six bedroom apartment above this place. I'm like, well, how would I go about getting, you know, permits and stuff? And he's like, don't worry, that's all taken care of. I'm like, I don't see how this is. He goes, trust me. And I'm like, okay, I'll see you tomorrow. I'm going to book a flight right now. And I booked a flight, flew there the next day, met with the guy. Sure enough, man, I look in the kitchen, everything you need, pots, pans, knives, plates, forks, everything except for the food. Got a walk-in cooler. Look in the venue. Some junk piled in the back. It's like, it needs a little bit of work, but, you know, not too bad. I go up the stairs. They've remodeled the second floor. Fucking amazing. There's three bedrooms, and one giant, giant room. And then there's a closet that's big enough for a bedroom, for real, like a bigger than most bedrooms. Then there's a whole top floor that's giant. And he's like, yeah, $1,000 a month covers all utilities. I just need people to get into my bar. And I'm like, you're sold. Here's $6,000 for the next 6 months of rent. I'll see you next week. And I flew home and I just quit everything. And that's why, because LA had changed quite a bit at that point. You know, like,
was that to do with grunge and that?
I think, yeah, maybe a little bit, but mostly, you know, like, also people had grown up, you know, like, I was 21 when I moved there.
Yeah.
22, you know, and it, I was 31. So a lot of those same people that were really crazy and fun had settled down. The music had changed. I tried with so many different bands, and, like, you know, I was playing gigs where you'd make $100 a night, or, you know, whatever, 200 if you were doing good. But it wasn't paying the bills. I was still going to have to work.
Yeah.
And this seemed like a good way to get out of it. And I loved New Orleans, and I'd met so many cool people when I was there a couple of months before that I really just wanted to get back there. It looked like it, like I said, it was kind of the Wild West then. It really was crazy back then. So,
and what an amazing opportunity as well. What, like, an absolute steal of a bargain. $1,000 a month for, like, I mean, you could have rented out one or two rooms and then got that back just from that.
Oh, easily. I mean, I immediately got a friend of mine, Christian Chirac, who is a friend of mine that had just moved to LA from Switzerland, and he was a great chef. And I was like, look, I can't pay you, but this will be our business. Like, you come, we got a place to live. We'll share everything, you know? And he's like, okay. So he came out, and then my friend Rich Siegel, whose parents owned a restaurant in New Orleans. He still owns it now. But at the time, his parents owned it, and I got him as a partner. And then we asked a couple other friends if they wanted to work there. We're like, look, we can't pay you, but you can keep the tips, and we'll feed you and keep you, you know, give you drinks and stuff. And then we started playing there. You know, we had a lot of cool bands come in. One of our local bands was our friend John Stewart, who now plays with Wilco. He had a great band, still does, with his sister Lori, called Blue Mountain. They played there quite a bit. We were open from like midnight till 6 a.m. at the venue. So we would get, even though all the places in New Orleans, you know, all the bars are open 24 hours, most of the venues are done by midnight, 12:30.
So you could get that, all that business of people still wanting to dance and see a live band after midnight.
Absolutely. I mean, there were other places that had late night stuff, but not that many that had late music. But we did it. We were very successful. Unfortunately, there was a fire there about 7 or 8 months into it. And that kind of, the people that owned the building weren't insured. So unfortunately, that was the end of that, which led to me moving back. But it was one of the greatest times of my life, for sure.
Do you think that fire was almost a metaphorical, like the times were too good, it had to end? Was it a bit like that?
Could be, you know, like, I don't know. It was really sad at the time because I loved it. But we lived there because I'd already paid another 6 months rent. So I had the place for another 4 or 5 months, but we didn't have it had destroyed the electrical system. So I was living there, and by June it was starting to get really hot and mosquitoes, and we didn't have electricity. We kind of like ran an extension cord from the house next door and had a power strip so that we had two lamps and two fans in the place. But it was crazy. And at that point, I got a call from Hutch, who you've met Hutch before. He does sound, he doesn't anymore, but he did sound for Queens and Caius. And
he's the guy. Jack, yeah, White. Man.
Yeah. So
does he still live out in the desert with you and Brian? Are you still all out there?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
He has a really great sound company out here now. So he does all the sound stuff up in the high desert. So he doesn't tour anymore, but he does all the cool festivals and stuff here. But he and I have been best friends since, you know, the mid eight, like the later 80s. So he knew that I was, you know, just kind of hanging in New Orleans. He goes, hey, you know, I'm going to Europe with Caius and they need a guitar tech. You know, I know you're not a guitar tech per se, but if you want to go, you know, it pays and it doesn't pay a lot, but we can go to Europe and you can get out of there for a minute. I'm like, hell yeah, that'd be great. Cause I knew the Caius guys. We were all friends and I love their music. And, you know, Hutch was my best friend. So we were going to be roommates and just hanging and going through Europe. And so I went to Europe with those guys and ended up meeting some more people that are best friends to this day. And while we're there, we all became great friends. And when they broke up, that's when Josh asked if I wanted to start Queens of the Stone Age with him. So it all kind of, you know, I guess it's all being at the right time. I mean, being at the right place at the right time and circumstances throwing you into different things, you know, like I really hated losing the restaurant. That was a huge blow, but then I'd never been to Europe and I ended up meeting tons of friends. And then that led to me starting Queens of the Stone Age with Josh. And then that led to me coming back and doing Earthlings with Fred and starting, cause I started the studio when I was in New Orleans. Fred had called me out of the blue and asked me to, if I wanted to be a partner in his studio in Joshua Tree. And I just said, yes, not knowing I would ever actually be out here again, but it just seemed like the thing to do. So yeah, everything just kind of works for a reason. As sad as I was that didn't happen, I'm where I'm at today, and I couldn't be happier about that.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Dude, it's so wild. Like, as you say, there's definitely an element of the luck of the draw and right time, right place. But I also truly believe that good things happen to good people without being too hippy-dippy about it. And because you're such a rad dude, and I didn't know any of these stories you've been sharing with me till today, like, that could have only happened to someone like you that just has something cool and positive about them. Because talk about falling from, like, you've basically, like, fell through life upwards. Do you know what I mean? If that makes sense. Like, every day there's like, oh, there's this new thing that just, oh, it might lead to something. And then, oh my God, the next thing you know, like, it's this whole other amazing chapter. And none of it's planned. None of it's contrived. None of it's, you know, you haven't gone chasing after it. It's just really organically, flukily panned out that way. It's incredible.
It's you know, I can't say enough about how lucky I am, how, you know, how fortunate everything has worked in my favor. The funniest thing is when I said Jimmy Ford's name earlier, I got a text from him right when I said his name, which is,
wow,
another one of really strange, you know, because we're still best friends. We still play together in the Gnarl Tones, which is a band that I started with him there. And then I play in Pink Slip, which is a band that his wife started to play Mardi Gras parades. And I still go down there and play with them. And they have a band called Danola, and I produce them and get them to come out here to record. So, yeah, I mean, I'm the most fortunate guy ever. Like, I just, you know, I try to stay positive, and I kind of learned from the restaurant burning, because that was such a huge blow, and I really thought that I couldn't recover after that, especially the night that it happened. And
yeah.
Once I realized that it wasn't going to continue, because the people that owned the building were like, we can't afford to fix it. And, you know, if you want to buy it, you can. I couldn't get anyone to buy it with me. So I was pretty devastated at that point. But then as I look back, it's just like, you know, just stay positive and, you know, strive for life to take you to an even better place because of the misfortunes.
I know what you mean as well, because, you know, throughout my life, things have happened. I've lost jobs, and sometimes it's more than just a way of making money. Like, my first big gig that I lost was working on Kerrang Radio, and when I was on that station, that was my life and everything was built around it, and then they closed down and had to make load of redundancies and stuff. And it's that same sort of thing. It's like, you're not just watching your business go up in smoke, but you're watching this life that you've built with these people that you love, and then you just think, oh, well, how can I come back from this? How can I replace or move forward? You know, when something like that has just been taken away so unexpectedly, it's hardcore, isn't it? But I think when you have those struggles in life, particularly earlier on, and you learn that life does go on, it stands you in good stead for further down the road, doesn't it? It's like, okay, things will work out. We've just got to keep our head down and push forward here.
Exactly. Yep. I mean, that's the biggest thing I learned from the restaurant was, I really thought I was so devastated. I didn't think there was any way to come back from that, but I couldn't be happier where I am today. So you just got to keep, you know, who knows what tomorrow is going to bring. So you just got to keep your head up and stay positive.
Amen, Davey. Well, dude, that was amazing. Some backstory on the catching. I feel like I'm really up to speed now with the wild ride you've been on. If you don't mind, dude, I want to just go in on some of the iconic, legendary records and bands and projects you've been involved in. There's so many, we won't get through them all, but you just mentioned there that, you know, after that stint with Caius around Europe and Caius come to an end, that's when Josh comes to you and says, sort of, I'm toying around with this new thing here. Now, some people might not know this, but you were involved from, you know, the ground floor up with that band. I wonder if you could just talk us through in more detail, perhaps the end of Caius, what Josh was up to, because he was up in Seattle for a bit, right, playing with Screaming Trees as well, and that's how the Lanigan connection begins. And then he decides, I want to start this project, and you were the guy that sort of helped him early on get that going.
Yeah, so he was up. He went back to school after Caius, and he moved up to Seattle, and he started playing with Screaming Trees, and we actually played a show together, Earthlings and Screaming Trees, at the Roxy, and we all hung out, and he was talking about starting his own band and was like, would you, you know, maybe I can do some stuff at Rancho. So he came down and we were working on that. He had some songs, and Fred was playing drums actually on the demo, on the original demos. And then he was like, look, I think we should do it. I found this bass player, and I think that Brant might play drums, Brant Bjork, and if you know, you on guitar. So we recorded a bunch of stuff at Rancho originally with that, and then he was doing some stuff up there with Matt Cameron and John McBain, and they actually played a show or two, I think, up there. And then we started doing more stuff, putting it together here and getting the songs more together. And, so that's kind of how that happened. And then we started putting it together with, the Brant thing didn't come out. We auditioned a couple of people, and then he went for Alfredo.
Yeah.
And then he said he picked, Oliveri back in the, you know, in the fold. So, but then we started rehearsing the four of us, and that's how we ended up first starting touring with that band, that version of the band.
I love the link between the Seattle scene and the desert scene. Like, you wouldn't sort of see a lineage there that brings these two worlds together. But the more you delve into it, obviously Stone Gossard signed Queens of the Stone Age. Is that right as well?
That's correct. Yeah, on his label.
That's so nuts. And wasn't Dave Grohl, obviously everybody knows he was on Songs for the Deaf, but wasn't he kind of coming out that way and linking up and jamming with you guys slightly after Kurt passed, just to try and escape all of that? Didn't he come out and hang out for a bit earlier on then as well?
Yeah, Pete Stahl brought him out because he had played in Scream with Pete. And yeah. Pete was like, I think you should come out and meet Fred and Dave and check out the Rancho, because, you know, I think you would enjoy it. So he came out, and we immediately recorded a bunch of stuff. We released one song, and we have a ton of tapes of our jams, you know. I had met Dave before that, too, because he was a big Caius fan and a Queens fan, so... We had a great time. We recorded a lot of different things. So that's how he ended up coming here for the first time. I think it was within months of Kurt's passing, I believe.
Fucking hell. I mean, that's, I guess with your place, right, it seems to have been a place of refuge for a lot of people over the years. And, you know, having been there myself, there's definitely something spiritual. There's a bit of voodoo magic going on there. And obviously because it's so isolated and out the way, I guess it must be, you know, you live there, so it's different for you, but I guess for a lot of other people, it must be like a place of retreat, right? Where you can go and regroup and kind of just get your head together and create. And I guess you must have seen over the years a lot of people, you know, almost like a lighthouse out in the desert, and people are just getting out there to reset and regroup. Is that correct? Is that safe to say? Have you had that a lot over the years?
Absolutely. You know, my first trip into Joshua Tree was on my first trip to LA with the Modifiers. We drove through the park because our guitar player, Bob Ohm, had said, you know, back then you didn't have iPhones and stuff, so you actually looked at the road map, you know, and he's like, oh, let's check out this park. We're making great time. Let's just cruise through. And so we drove through and we all were blown away, you know. And then I didn't really come back until the mid to late 80s. I think I just kept seeing it on commercials, and I decided I would drive out. I had a convertible, same kind of one I have now, and just remember putting the top down and driving out here and, you know, re-falling in love with it and coming out here quite a bit. And then when Fred moved out, coming to stay with him a few times, and then when we started the studio, that's when, you know, I spent a lot more time out here and more people wanted to come and visit and record. And back then there weren't a lot of people out here. Pappy and Harriet's was one of the, there were like three bars out here, Pappy and Harriet's, the Circle Bar, or I'm sorry, the Winner's Circle, and Joshua Tree Saloon. Those were like, and then there were a couple in 29 Palms, but the two in Joshua Tree. So there wasn't a whole lot of nightlife and not a lot of people. It's changed considerably even since you were last here. I mean, you know, this is now the, what they call the Brooklyn of LA, you know,
right.
It's where all the people are coming out of LA because no one can afford a house in LA. And now that people can work from their homes more often than not, you know, everybody, you know, why would you pay $700,000 for a house in LA when you can get a great house, a better house for $200,000 out here? And so it's changed a lot. There's a lot more people out here. You know, when we first started the studio, hardly anyone lived out here. Our friend Victoria Williams and a few of our friends. And then later people were like, oh man, we love Joshua Tree. We'll just buy like our weekend house. You know, and then a lot of people were living in weekend houses, but now people are actually moving out here. There's a really cool scene of, you know, a lot of younger kids are coming out here, a lot of cool artists, a lot of cool restaurants have opened up, a lot of really nice people. So it's a lot different. And even, I mean, I think the last time you were here was, what, 3 years ago, 4 years ago?
2015.
Damn, has it been that long?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's definitely changed a lot since 2015, for sure.
And you're all for it. You're on board. You like what you see.
I do. You know, I mean, it kind of sucks as far as like a little bit of traffic goes and a little more lights, especially in Joshua Tree. But, you know, that was bound to happen, man. It's a beautiful place. Of course people are going to want to come, especially when it's so close to L.A. You know, it's an easy escape for people.
I want to ask you about Rated R, Davey, if that's cool. Yeah. Like, that record is just one of the most fucking ferocious, phenomenal, incredible records of the last 20 years. It's so good. It still sounds so good. Was that the one you were the most involved with the creation of in terms of playing on track?
Yeah. Oh, of course. Yeah. That was really fun because we actually had been playing together for a while. Couple of years at that point. Josh had done the first album pretty much by just him and Alfredo, and then the second one he and Nick came up and they actually stayed up here in Joshua Tree and wrote a couple of the songs, and then I started joining in on my parts, and then we had Chris Goss come in to produce it, and It was a really interesting time because Alfredo had a falling out with Josh, so he didn't want to play on the record, and so we brought in our friend Gene Troutman, who's still one of my best friends and one of the greatest drummers, and then they were trying other, you know, different people in for different things, but it was so fun recording that for the most part, you know, like there were some nights where, I mean, we were on a pretty tight deadline, so some nights it wouldn't be going as quickly as it should have been, and it got a little tense here and there, but for the most part it was so much fun because we were just laughing and having a great time and experimenting, you know, and it was really cool for me because Josh wanted to include one of my songs on the record, which he did, the Lightning song, and all the other songs are just, they were so fun to play, and it did really change a lot of the way people thought about harder rock, I think, especially at the time. And it was just a good time to do that record.
I'll never forget the first time I heard that the band. It was off a free CD given out with Kerrang, and the song on it was Leg of Lamb. And it just sounded so unusual and slinky and, you know, kind of a lot more effeminate, but in a very dark kind of voodoo weird way. And
yeah,
it was just this crazy melting pot of amalgamations of all different influences. And I'd never heard anything like it before. And then you get the record and there's, you know, everything from Feel Good Here the Summer to Autopilot to Lost Art Keeping a Secret, Monster in the Parasol. Like every song is its own little island and beast and curiosity. And I mean, those two at that time, what was it like working up close and seeing that relationship, that songwriting duo of Nick and Josh? Because, I mean, for me, I like most of the stuff that the Queens have done over the years, but for me, those first three records are like the pinnacle gold standard. And I do think a lot of it is to do with that, the push and the pull and the interplay between Nick and Josh and what they both bring to the table and how they balance the other one out just when it comes to like a songwriting thing.
Well, it was really great to watch that because those times we were having a lot of fun. We were touring and having a great time. I mean, you know, when we toured together, it was me, Josh, Nick, Alfredo, Hutch, and Pete Stahl was the tour manager on a lot of those early tours, and we were touring in a van. You know, and I remember we played in like St. Louis to like five people, and you know, it was a really ground floor start to that band, you know. It, first of all, the name, he wanted a name that would kind of like hopefully draw some girls into it because Caius was mostly dudes, you know.
Yeah. And perhaps piss off some more of the macho conservative metal brigade, right? In a way as well, poke them a little bit.
Exactly. But yeah, watching them write together was super fun. I mean, we were all really great friends, and we were having a blast. We were getting to travel the world and play music, and people really liked it, and it picked up fast. It was just like the first tour that only a few people were in a lot of the towns. You know, I remember we pulled into Milwaukee, and it looked like someone's house. You know, we were like, "What is it? This is supposed to be a bar?" And it was just someone's house that they'd built a bar in the living room, and we were playing in like the basement, like pool room that someone had had. It was, you know, like you played all sorts of weird gigs like that. So all those are really fun. And you're writing on the road too, because you got guitars and you got plenty of time. And it was a very, very interesting time. And then recording the record at Sound City was, you know, I mean, besides the fact that, you know, some of the coolest records ever are recorded there, it was a really great studio. Everybody that worked there was super cool. And it just felt really, it was a giant honor to be doing that. And, you know, and I still love that album to this day. I mean, I love all the albums. They all have their vibes, but that one is very special because it did change the way a lot of like heavier bands were playing, I think. But yeah, hanging out with Josh and Nick writing was hilarious. Those guys, two of the funniest dudes ever.
You must have had some amazing experiences on the road as well, like with other bands. What about kind of from a touring point of view, which bands at that time were beginning to take Queens out before they became the headlining kind of big draw? You must have been on some big tours as the support act, right?
Not so well. One was really great. Was Ween took us out.
Wow.
They were one of our favorite bands, and they had taken Caius out. So we were really good friends with those guys. And just being around them, they're one of the best live bands ever, I think.
I've never seen them. I really want to. I love Ween so much. They just rarely make it over to the UK.
Yeah. You know, I love them so much that once I quit Queens, they called me looking for a drum tech for a European tour. And I told them I would do it.
just to hang out with them. I love it.
Yeah, I was like, I put drum sets together. I get to watch you guys every night. Yeah, let's do it. So that was a good one. They had a couple of bands. Like they went out on this really small theater tour with Smashing Pumpkins, but I had already booked an Earthlings tour at that time, so I didn't do that tour. But for the most part, we were doing most of our own shows, yeah, other than the Ween tour.
And you saw, obviously, the band blow up, right? Did you witness that happen? As you say, it started off small, you're grinding away. After that, after Rated R comes out, I know that wasn't quite the juggernaut that Songs for the Deaf was, but it was still a huge record. And did you notice, like, their fortunes and favors change in the moment?
Oh, absolutely. With that album, for sure, because it got so much press, because it was like, you know, journalists really loved that album, you know, so that really helped considerably.
With the Songs for the Deaf record, you know, the radio voiceovers, did you record them at the Rancho, or was it all done in the studio at Sound City?
No, that album was done at Barefoot Studios in Hollywood.
Right.
And we all did them that night together.
So it was like, the case that everybody there, so there's like Casey Chaos, obviously there's Twiggy, there's Lux, Blag, you're all there for one night together and doing it in one session. That must have been one hell of a night.
Yeah, Lux wasn't there for that, so I don't know where he recorded his, but everybody else, I remember they made it into a big party. They bought a bunch of like booze and food, and you know, I'll just never forget how much we laughed that night, because it was just fucking hilarious. Like, because there's, I mean, obviously you hear what's on the record, but you don't hear the other 20 takes of whatever was done.
Yeah,
you know. But yeah, it was that was the best part. That album had some. I was invited to play on some of that record, and a couple of times I went down. It was pretty tense. A couple of times I split pretty early, because I don't know what the problems were. I don't know, but it wasn't the happy-go-lucky, and I'm not saying the whole time, but a couple of times when I went, I stayed for 30 minutes, and the vibe was so bad I split. But it made for a great record. I think it's the best Queens like real rock, you know, album.
That's because I was going to say, you know, obviously the lineup for that one, you've got Dave Grohl on drums, you've got Lanigan in the mix as well. I was going to ask why you decided to step back and walk away from it, but was that part of it? Was just you felt like the tides had turned and it wasn't that same fun experience? Obviously, you've got the Rancho that you're living at and running and doing that as well. But yeah, did you just feel like, wow, things have changed a bit here? It's not for me.
Well, I honestly, it was kind of a mutual thing. I was starting to do well. Also, when I was turning down tours opening for Smashing Pumpkins to go out and do Earthling stuff, because Earthlings is my band with Fred and Pete, and I was a lot more concerned about doing that, and that was happening more often than not. And then Queens were offered Lollapalooza, and I thought that was a really terrible idea. It started in Florida in July, and we were like the first band on the bill, or second band, you know. It was just like I was like why would we do that? That's stupid, you know. We're better than that. And they really wanted to do it, and you know, at the time I think we were making like $200 a week, you know. It wasn't even paying the bills.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I mean, $200 a week doesn't pay the bills, and then especially if you're on the road, you're spending it. And so I didn't really want to do it, and I kept saying I didn't want to do it. And finally, Josh was like, "Okay, well then we'll just get somebody else to do it," and that was kind of the end. So it was kind of on both of our parts. I think it was a lot of me passing on certain tours, and you know, at the time too, you know, it's always more fun playing the music that you write than,
of course,
than what somebody else is saying, like play this and play that. And I, you know, I think the best thing he ever did was to get Troy in the band too, you know. Like Troy is such a fucking amazing musician and the coolest dude. So I think he's a much better fit for that band than I was anyway. But I certainly had a good time for the years I did play in the band.
I want to ask you just a couple more things before we approach the end, Davey, because, you know, we've been going for ages and I feel like I could talk to you all day, but we'll save some more for another time. I wanted to ask about the experience of making the Iggy Pop record out of the Rancho, because I gather you mentioned Troy there and it reminded me of it. Troy said that they started like rehearsing and jamming for the tour that they went on with Iggy, like the day after Bowie died or something. Is that so? Was this around the time he was making that record as well, or was that before, or was that after?
Before for sure. That album was super, super fun to make because, first of all of us involved were huge Iggy fans. Like,
of course,
you know, and he's hilarious. And the sessions would start at, like, I think we were meeting at the house next door. Josh and Iggy were staying at the house that Hutch and I used to live in, that's next door. It's the guest house for most of the sessions. And Hutch and his girl Amanda were cooking for the sessions, and we would meet up there at 10 for breakfast, and we'd have this delicious breakfast. And then as soon as we were done eating, me and Mark and the rest of the dudes, we would come down to the studio and get everything set up and going, and, you know, mics up, turn everything on, make sure everything's working. And those guys would roll up, you know, around like 11:30 or so. And then we would start recording at noon and go noon to 5. And then at 5, we'd have a glass of wine, go up to the house, relax, listen to music, and then we would have a big dinner, and we were done by like 8:30, and that was the you know, that was the day. It was so killer, you know.
What was it like watching him just do the Iggy Pop magic as well? It must have been amazing seeing that, because obviously your place is, people won't know if they haven't been there, because it's this legendary place, but it's not massive, is it? It's very intimate, it's very small. What was it like up close? I know you've known him for years as well, but like working up that close and personal with the icon that is Iggy, it must have been such an amazing thing to witness and be a part of.
Well, it was really great because everybody involved in that was super cool. You know, Justin, who works with Josh, he was helping me. Like, he and I were like the dudes that would do all the gopher work. And then Mark Rankin, who's amazing and super cool. And then you got, you know, Dean and Matt Helders and Josh, and then Iggy. So like, everybody's on top of their game. Everybody's cool. Everybody's funny. Iggy's just right. You know, just having Iggy sit in my house writing lyrics and stuff. And
yeah,
you know, it, everything about it was super cool. And it, you know, like you said, it is tight in here. It's not like, you know, this giant studio where somebody's in one room and, you know, the control room, you know, basically my house is about the size of a control room at, you know, A&M or something. But yeah, I mean, it couldn't have been a cooler experience just to be around, because it was a few weeks too. So, you know, like 3 or 4 weeks that we were all hanging out, because they were just writing as they went along. And it was great. I remember Josh had this amazing booklet that Iggy had sent him talking about, you know, how he had worked with Bowie and like, you know, how they, and I it was so cool reading that, because he was like, if we're going to do this record, this, you know, this is kind of how it, this is what I did with Bowie, you know, and that was really cool. But yeah, to see everybody on top of their game recording with Iggy Pop in my house, yeah, it's pretty surreal and amazing.
What a life, Davey. What a life.
Yes, sir.
It's been all right, hasn't it? There's been some hurdles along the way, but it's been, on the whole, a pretty glorious, beautiful existence, man. And I consider myself grateful to call you a friend, dude. It's been lovely catching up with you, and it's been lovely hearing about the backstory of Davey C. I had no idea about half this stuff.
Well, you know what? I feel honored to call you a friend. You've always been a bright, beaming light anytime I've seen you, and I always love seeing you, and I hope to see a lot more of you as soon as things calm down around the world.
Hell yeah, man. We're going to make it happen. I'm coming out, and you've given me the idea for book number 2 next year. If the world's back into, you know, regular routine by then, the Pappy and Harriet's launch show sounds amazing. There's a few cats from your world that are going to be in that book as well, yourself now included, now you've been on the show. But yeah, that sounds like the absolute dream. And if you put it out there, if one thing I've learned from this conversation with you tonight, Davey, if you put it out there, you know, it comes back around, right?
Yes, it does. And we'll make it happen for sure. That is one thing, is Pappy and Harriet has not closed. They have the outdoor. So they I'm sure they're struggling hard, but they've kept it going. So that's one good thing.
I love it. Davey, I think there's only one way we can end this chat. If you're up for it, would you mind doing the Songs for the Deaf sign off?
David Catching here, not saying goodnight, just saying.
Dude, thank you so much, man. That was a beautiful talk. I really, really, really enjoyed that.
I love you, Matt. You take care.
You too, brother. Till next time, Dave. All right. Cheers, man.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.